Okay, well, I think perhaps we should start. It's an honour for me to be introducing the winner of the 1999 Lactos Award, Brian Skirms. The Lactos Award, for those of you who haven't been to this occasion before, was set up in 1985, I think, to honour the best recent book in philosophy of science in each year. It was set up courtesy of the generosity of the Lactis Foundation in honour of the memory of Imre Lakatos, who was a very charismatic and influential philosopher of mathematics and philosophy of science, who was Hungarian, fled to England in 1956, and made his career, having got a PhD, for second PhD from Cambridge, made his career here at the school in our department, in what was then Popper's department, becoming professor of logic with special reference to the philosophy of mathematics before dying tragically early in 1974. And this award was set up, as I say, in his honour, courtesy of the generosity of the Lactis Foundation. So Brian Skirms is from the University of California, Irvine, where he's distinguished professor of logic and philosophy of science and economics, and the director of the interdisciplinary program in history and philosophy of science, well known for many years for his contributions to such fields as inductive logic and decision theory. His books, Choice and Chance, already I think into a fourth edition, of Causal Necessity, have long been well known. And more recently, he's been moving into the area of the evolution of the social contract, an earlier book on dynamics of rational deliberation, and now the book, Evolution of Social Contract, for which he's won the Lakatos Award. Something tells me that there may be some connection between the remarks he's going to make today and the book, because the title of the lecture is exactly the same title as the book, Evolution of the Social Contract. So, Brian Skirms.
Thanks very much.
You may need to pull that microphone over, I suppose.
Oh, this is my microphone.
This is my microphone here. How's that? Let me begin by setting the context a little bit. Hobbes wanted to develop a theory of the social contract along the lines of Euclidean geometry, with all the rigor that he found in Euclid's derivations. And the idea was to derive the theory from the postulates of rational action. This is a program that more recently has been formalized by von Neumann and Morgenstern and people following them in the development of game theory. In fact, I'd like to quote a distinguished modern game theorist, Roger Meyerson, who's made the observation that modern game theory is the continuation of Hobbes' great work. Okay. It's a quotation which I pinched from the back of Ken Binmore's book on the social contract. And so there's a certain lineage that goes from Hobbes to von Neumann to John Nash, John Harsanyi, Robert Aumann, that builds a theory of social interaction on the basis of postulates of rationality. There is a somewhat different tradition in social philosophy that is sometimes seen as being opposed to the theory of the social contract. and sometimes seen as being a different kind of theory of the social contract. I like to think of it in this way, that we can trace back at least to David Hume. And my Hume quotation
is right in green.
A famous passage that half the audience knows from memory, but the rest of you might take a look at. Two men who pull at the oars of a boat do it by an agreement or convention, though they have never given promises to each other, nor is the rule concerning the stability of possession the less derived from human conventions, that it arises gradually and acquires force by a slow progression. In like manner, our language is established by human conventions without any promise. In a way, Rousseau is also in this tradition, and many other thinkers that we could name. It too must have a modern counterpart, right? And it does. And what is that modern counterpart? I would say it's evolutionary game theory, with evolution taken in a broad sense. Developed by biologists, economists, and a number of other thinkers. John Maynard Smith, with his work on evolutionary game theory, late William Hamilton, Bob Sugden, Ken Binmore, in his 2-volume work on the social contract, and elsewhere. Okay. And this is the tradition that I want to work in myself. Okay. But in the talk tonight, I'm going to tell you something about both traditions, I guess. Like Hobbes and Hume, there are great similarities in many of the things that they say, but there are also some differences. And game theory in our own times, based on rational choice, has great similarities with game theory based on evolutionary dynamics, but there are also certain differences that are important to attend to. And I'd like to talk about the importance of both the similarities and differences for some issues that impact facets of the social contract. I should try to make it clear that when I talk about evolution, by evolution here I don't necessarily mean genetic evolution. Cultural evolution is part of the picture too. Okay? More general, what I mean and what people in the field mean when talking about evolutionary game theory is a rather more general discipline, which is based on a theory of adaptive processes. Okay? Learning is a kind of adaptive process. Social learning, cultural learning, and biological learning are adaptive processes. Nothing that I say is going to rest on anything being genetically determined or genetically undetermined, right? This is a point that's going to be made using rather general properties of adaptive processes. Now, you might think that both of these things might come out more or less the same, but I'm going to argue that there are differences both in the details of the outcome and in the foundations of the theory, even when the details of the outcome may be the same. So I want to talk a little bit first about a theory of interaction based on rationality assumptions. Okay? The central solution concept in game theory based on rationality assumptions is that of a Nash equilibrium. Okay? And a Nash equilibrium is simply a combination of plays or acts by various people who are interacting, such that if any person was to deviate unilaterally, that person would not be any better off. Okay? It's a kind of stability concept, weak stability concept. Okay? Looking at games, we look for Nash equilibria, at least at first. And why should people play Nash equilibria? Well, there's an argument, but that argument has various difficulties. So the first part of my talk is called Nash in Trouble. And what's in trouble is the use of Nash equilibrium as the univocal concept of game theory based on assumptions of rationality. There is an argument for Nash equilibrium from rationality that's to be found in von Neumann and Morgenstern's theory of games and economic behavior. It's based on two things. There is a theory of rationality which all the players are described by, but also which all the players subscribe to. Okay. Modern analysis has uncovered stronger assumptions, that is, the assumption that players not only know the theory of rationality, but each knows that the other knows it, and the other knows that he knows it, and so on. That is, that there is common knowledge of rationality. Okay. Von Neumann and Morgenstern argue that the theory of rationality should be a theory that tells you what to do. So given a choice problem, it will give you a unique rational action to perform in this choice situation. If it prescribes a unique rational action and everyone knows and there's common knowledge of the theory of rationality, then everyone knows what the rational action for all players are. And the rational action then can't be anything such that a player would gain by unilateral deviation from, because everyone knows what the plays are, and if you could gain by unilateral deviation, that player would deviate. Right? So, the solution has to be a Nash equilibrium. Well, there are two assumptions that go into this kind of solution. That the rational choice is unique and that we have common knowledge of rationality. Let's look at these two assumptions. The assumption of uniqueness of rational choice is not a bad assumption in the context in which von Neumann and Morgenstern had prime interest, and that was the theory of zero-sum games. Because in a sense, there is a unique choice that's prescribed in zero-sum games. There's a unique Nash equilibrium. The sense is not literally that there's a unique Nash equilibrium, but it doesn't make any difference. There's an equivalence class of Nash equilibria, and play of one is really strategically equivalent to play of the other. However, if we move from zero-sum games, that is, games where what one player wins, the other player loses, to more general games, this is no longer true. So I want to give two examples. First, a very simple one. This is a coordination game. Player that is given by row here chooses red, green, or blue. The player that is the column chooser chooses red, green, or blue. And the payoffs are row chooser, column chooser. So the payoffs are simply, if they choose the same color, they get it, both get a good payoff. If they choose different colors, they get a bad payoff. Okay. There are television games like this in the United States in which couples are asked to choose things, and the payoffs are arranged this way, but they have to make their choices independently. Okay. Simple coordination game. There are three Nash equilibria. Both choose red, both choose green, both choose blue. If the theory of rationality is to prescribe a unique choice, it must select one of these equilibria as the correct rational choice. But from the symmetry of the problem, it seems incredible that you could think that a theory of rationality would be powerful enough to give a reason why one of these equilibria is any better than the other one. But then the players can be rational as you please, and there can be common knowledge of rationality, and they're hauled off to play this game, and they don't know what to do. Right? Because if one rationally aims at one equilibrium and the other rationally aims at another equilibrium, they get nothing. Here is a slightly more complicated example of the same problem, okay, but something that has a little more philosophical significance. This is a signaling game. These were introduced actually by David Lewis in his PhD thesis, at least to the best of my knowledge, which was then published as a book called Convention. And more general forms of the game were later introduced into the economics literature by Vince Crawford and Joel Sobel in a paper called Strategic Information Transmission. Here's the setup. There are a number of states of the world, in this example just three, which the sender can observe, so that the sender finds out something about the world. There are a number of acts that the receiver can perform which have payoff consequences to both the sender and the receiver. Okay. And the nice thing about the problem that the sender and receiver face is that they have exactly the same interests in the payoffs. That is, sender gets payoff of one in exactly the same case that receiver gets the payoff of one. Otherwise, they both get the payoff of zero. Okay, so it's in both their interest to aim for a state in getting a payoff of one. Okay, that is, receiver does act one in state one of the world, act two in state two of the world, act three in state three of the world. But how are they going to achieve this? Well, the sender has signals. So the sender observes the state of the world and then can send a signal to the receiver. Okay. But the thing about the problem that isn't so nice is that the signals have no preassigned meaning. Okay. So the signals you could think of as simply something that the sender can do that the receiver will notice, and such that the receiver can distinguish between the signals. You could think of them, for instance, to fix the imagination, as being three different colored flags that the sender could wave, but with no pre-assigned code assigned to which color flag means which state of the world. Lewis talks about these systems because he's interested in the possibility of analyzing meaning as an equilibrium in such a sender-receiver game. Okay. There are equilibria where it is not unreasonable to think of the signals as having acquired meaning by the structure of the equilibrium of the interaction. So, if the sender has the strategy of sending signal 1 in state 1, signal 2 in state 2, signal 3 in state 3, and the receiver has the strategy of doing act 1 when he sees signal 1, act 2 when he sees signal 2, act 3 when he sees signal 3, okay, then they're at an equilibrium, and it's an equilibrium where it's not unreasonable to say that signal 1 means state 1, and signal 2 means state 2, and signal 2 means state 3. Okay, but if we permute the system, the signals in both the sender's strategy and the receiver's strategy, we get another system which is just as good, where the information gets across, where the receiver always does the right thing in the right state of the world. So there are many signaling systems which are equilibria, which carry the meaning across. Okay, Lewis calls them signaling system equilibria. Economists call them separating equilibria. So again, in a slightly more complicated context, we're faced with the problem of multiple Nash equilibria where one isn't any better than the other in any reasonable sense, right? The symmetry of the situation makes each as good as the other. Well, that's the problem of equilibrium selection. And if you're in a game with multiple equilibria and you don't know which equilibrium to shoot for and your partner doesn't know either, then you're in trouble, and the whole rationale for the Nash equilibrium concept as being the right solution concept unravels. Well, that was the first assumption that was used to justify the Nash equilibrium concept, right? Uniqueness of equilibrium. And we've seen that it fails in dramatic ways in the general context of social interactions. The second assumption was common knowledge of rationality. And to deal with this assumption, I'd like to play a little game with some of the audience. Okay, not the whole audience, because it would take too long. So I think it might be right if we just did it with the balcony. Okay, here is a game that we'll play with people who are sitting in the balcony. I'd like each of you to choose a number between 1 and 100. Okay, we'll find out what the numbers are. My confederate standing by with a calculator will calculate the mean of the numbers. Okay, and the guesses that's closest to half of the mean will win the prize. Okay, whoever wins the prize should see Professor Worrell after the proceedings, and don't expect too much, but a small prize will be awarded to the winner of this game. Anybody can play. If you've seen this game before, if you've seen an analysis of it, if you know nothing about it, it's quite all right. Anyone can play. Okay. The only rule is play to win. Okay. Try to win, and don't cheat. That is, when other people have given out their numbers, don't change yours. Okay. So, would everybody in the balcony please just take a minute, decide what your number is. Okay. And either write it down or simply put it firmly in your mind. Okay. Now, I'll ask you to call out numbers, and we will calculate on the fly. So let's see. How many? 1, 2, 3, 4. Well, we'll see how many people give us numbers. I'll go down from 100. Has anybody chosen a number between 90 and 100? Has anyone chosen a number between 80 and 90? Yes, what is your number?
85.
Has anyone... Oh, another?
87.
Any others between 80 and 90? Between 70 and 80. Yes.
74.
75.
73.
73. Between 60 and 70. Yes.
69.
Between 50 and 60. Yes. 52. 50. Yes.
50.
Okay, there were two at 50. Between 40 and 50.
Yes.
43. 45. Between 30 and 40.
Yes.
32.
Okay. Any others in that range? Between 20 and 30. Between 10 and 20.
17.
16. 11. Between 0 and 10.
5.
That's it.
There's 17 up there. I don't know if everybody... Did everybody give a number?
Well, if somebody didn't play, that's all right.
Okay.
Did someone not play? Perfectly all right. If you gave me a number, raise your hand. We better do this right. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. I get 16.
I was counting the lady with the microphone.
Oh,
it's okay.
49 is the mean.
The mean is 49. Who was closest to the mean? Who gave us the 250s?
You and you.
Okay, so we'll have to split the prize between the 250s.
Good. Cut the book down the middle.
Now, the context of this game was to see that whether we have common knowledge of rationality among the players. Oh, yes. The point of the game was to see whether we had common knowledge of rationality among the players. You can play this game in any sort of audience, and you will never get an affirmative answer. Let's see what common knowledge of rationality would imply. The prize is to the person that guesses closest to half the mean. The highest possible that half the mean could be was 50. Right? Therefore, there's no point in guessing anything higher than 50. Right? That's not rational. My apologies to those of you who guessed higher than 50. Okay? So if there's common knowledge of rationality, no one will, or if there's rationality, no one will guess higher than 50. Okay? If there's common knowledge of rationality, everyone knows that no one will guess higher than 50, and therefore the highest that the mean can be is 25. Okay, so there's no point in guessing anything higher than 25, right? But if there's common knowledge of rationality, everybody knows that, so that the highest half the mean can be is 12.5. And you see how it goes. Common knowledge of rationality really implies that the guesses will all be zero. Okay. Now I've cheated a little bit in giving you a quick derivation, but can be made precise so that common knowledge of rationality does in fact have this conclusion that it drives the answer down to zero. But we don't have common knowledge of rationality. Sometimes when you do this, there's somebody in the audience who is an economist who knows all about this and tries to be very smart and guesses zero, right? And he never wins the prize. Oh, I thought you were giving me half the mean. 49 was the mean. All right. So half the mean was 24.5. Okay. Did anyone guess 24? 25, 23, 26, 22, 27. What? You guessed? 21. 28. Didn't someone guess 20? 20? 21, 29, 19, 30, 18, 31, 17. 17, you get the prize.
Okay, these are called,
well, we won't tell you what they're called. I guess I have to. These are called Keynesian beauty contest games because of a remark that Keynes made comparing the stock market to beauty contests that were run at the time in newspapers, where the prize was awarded to the person not who chose the prettiest picture, but the picture that was closest to the average picture that was chosen as the prettiest picture in some appropriate sense, or to the median prettiest picture. Beauty contest games have been tried out on all sorts of subjects, and Colin Kammerer, who's now at Caltech, collected these results. Sometimes they're played with the median, sometimes with the mean. And you see that we never get very close to zero, although we have quite a variation of pools here, from high school students in the U.S. to chief executive officers who are members of the Caltech Board of Trustees, who had a mean of 37. Okay. Well, common knowledge of rationality is hard to come by, right? And it's not an innocuous assumption that people operate as if there were common knowledge of rationality. So, from the Hobbesian side of the aisle, we move over to the Humean side of the aisle and talk about a rather different approach based on adaptive dynamics. I hope I don't offend anyone when I entitle this section Biology Inspires Economics. First concept that's useful is that of an evolutionarily stable strategy, introduced by Maynard Smith and Price. An evolutionarily stable strategy is a strategy such that if every member of the population follows it, then some rare mutant in the population who has a different strategy in this game or this kind of interaction that's modeled by a certain game will do worse on average, with the payoffs being calculated in terms of Darwinian fitness, that is, expected number of offspring. That's a static kind of equilibrium concept. To build a kind of dynamics behind the static concept, Taylor and Yonker, two Canadian mathematicians, introduced the replicator dynamics, where we have a very simple model of differential reproduction. Okay. those phenotypes who do better than the average in the population grow, those who do worse shrink in their proportion of the population, and they shrink according to a rather simple dynamical equation that can be derived in various ways. It can be derived from a model of haploid genetics or reproduction by cloning, right? Or it can be derived by various models of cultural evolution, which have evolution arising because people who are more successful in payoffs in something that everybody wants tend to get imitated more often than people who are less successful. Okay, and there are a number of derivations that derive this in a large population limit from different models of cultural evolution. It's also possible to have models of cultural evolution that are not quite the same as replicator dynamics, as for instance Binmore and Samuelson have shown, but which might be called replicator-like dynamics because they're qualitatively rather close to replicator dynamics. What happens if we do game theory in this biological or evolutionary setting? Well, we find out, and this is perhaps the most important point to bear in mind if you're not already conversant with this area, we find out that we can get Nash from a naturalistic evolutionary explanation. Every evolutionarily stable strategy in the biological sense is a strongly dynamically stable, that is, an attracting equilibrium in the replicator dynamics that ties static stability to dynamical stability. And if something's dynamically stable in the replicator dynamics, it corresponds to a Nash equilibrium in the corresponding game. Okay, so we have a bridge from the biological notion of evolutionarily stable strategy to the notion of Nash equilibrium, okay, that applies to anything that follows this adaptive dynamics. There isn't any common knowledge assumed here. There isn't any rationality assumed here. So those philosophers who would attack the use of game theory as an explanatory discipline on the basis that it assumes too much about rationality should be cautious and reconsider whether there are different routes to the Nash equilibrium concept that don't require any rationality at all. Okay, this is a route that works just as well for bacteria as for people. It works as well just for irrational actors as rational actors if it's applied in a proper manner. Okay, so that's the first big point, okay? You can't dismiss game theory because you think people are often irrational, or if you're more sophisticated because you want to say, even if they're rational, there's no common knowledge of rationality, because game theory may very well apply. And the route that it applies is through adaptive dynamics, and we need to study adaptive dynamics to have a reasonable theory of the social contract. Now, I said before that there are similarities between the adaptive dynamic approach to the social contract and the static rationality approach, just like there are similarities between Hume and Hobbes, but there are also differences. And so now I want to briefly say a little bit about some of the differences. The first difference is what I call the Darwinian veil of ignorance, and that is that in evolutionary game theory, it isn't the players that have a persistent identity, but it's the strategies. Okay, organisms come and go, right? What the dynamics operates on are the behaviors, right, or the phenotypes. Okay, they persist. Whereas in rational choice game theory, it's the players that have an identity, right? And there they are in two-person games, row and column, right? And they're different. Okay. So when I talked about the connection between Nash equilibrium and evolutionarily stable strategy, an evolutionary stable strategy corresponded not just to any equilibrium in a two-person game, but to a symmetric equilibrium in a symmetric two-person game. Okay. Well, that sounds like a little technical point, but it has real consequences if you're thinking in terms of social philosophy. The term veil of ignorance might give you a hint about these consequences. For instance, suppose you're playing a version of a bargaining game that was also introduced into the literature by John Nash called Divide the Dollar. Here's a game such that there's some resource, and the payoff to the guys playing this game is just proportional to amount of resource. And the game is played this way. They demand some proportion of the resource, and both make their demands, and if their demands are not compatible in that their demands add up to more than the whole resource, they get nothing, okay? The bargain is not struck, right? If their demands are compatible, they get what they demanded, okay? It's a little model, and we could spend a long time talking about what it's a model of, but it's a good model of important things in the social contract. Suppose you look at Divide the Dollar bargaining game and ask yourself first, what is an evolutionarily stable strategy in that game, okay? There is only one, and that's to demand a half. Okay, it's a point that Bob Sugden made in his book. There is a unique evolutionarily stable strategy here. Okay. If all the population demands more than a half, they can certainly be invaded because they're getting a payoff of zero. Okay, if they all demand less than a half, they can be invaded by somebody who demands a little bit more. So only when they demand half are we at an evolutionarily stable strategy. But there are also other states of the population that may be evolutionarily stable. That is, states where there's a mixture of people doing different things. Okay, and these are called polymorphic states of the population. So we have a kind of teaser in terms of equilibrium, right? An egalitarian teaser, right? In this game, there is a unique evolutionarily stable strategy. It's the egalitarian strategy, okay? If one type takes over the whole population, it will play this strategy. But we still have the dynamical question, will one type take over the whole population, or might not it get stuck in one of these mixed states of the population, which is a polymorphism, and some might do one strategy and some might do another? Well, this is a question that you can investigate quite precisely in carefully set up models of varying levels of realism as you build more and more into the evolutionary process. Just using the straight replicator dynamics is a first cut at it. Then you can put in other things. You can put in mutation. You can put in things about how people meet one another, and so on. And there's now a kind of literature growing up around this problem that has to do with evolution of egalitarian norms. Okay, I'm not going to spend a long time surveying it, but just point it out so that those of you that don't know this literature know that this is a way in which the stuff I'm telling you can focus in on something that's central to questions of the social contract. It wouldn't be true if there weren't a Darwinian veil of ignorance, right? I mean, the fact that the strategies are what survive and the actors live and die over the course of cultural evolution is what makes what I just said true. Okay. Let me move on to something else, which is modeled by a different game. Has anybody heard of The Prisoner's Dilemma? Too much space is spent on it, but I'll spend a little space on it too. Here's a prisoner's dilemma. The strategies are cooperate or defect. If both people cooperate, they get 10. If both people defect, they get 5, right? But if somebody else cooperates in a given encounter and you defect, you get 15. So if these are your real payoffs and your payoffs drive you, the rational thing to do is to defect because 15 is better than 10 and 5 is better than 0. So no matter what column does, row is better defecting and vice versa. However, suppose we look at this in an evolutionary context, right? People meet one another in a big population and play the prisoner's dilemma. And suppose it turns out that for some reason or other, right, people meet their own type more often than they meet other types, right? Cooperators meet cooperators more often than if they had just picked at random from the population. Defectors meet defectors more often than if they just picked at random from the population. Then it may be that cooperators take over the whole population. The way to see that without doing any calculation is look at the extreme case where the correlation is perfect. Then cooperators always meet cooperators and get a payoff of 10. Defectors always meet defectors and get a payoff of 5, right? Cooperators take over the whole population. Of course, doesn't have to be the perfect correlation for cooperators to do better than defectors. Just has to be good enough. Okay. This is something that was emphasized early on by William Hamilton and even earlier by Sewell Wright and later by John Maynard Smith. Population viscosity of this kind can promote cooperation where rational choice-based game theory would give the answer that defection has to take over. Well, why should you have viscosity? There are lots of reasons, right? There are group selection models of the kind that Elliot Sober and David Sloan Wilson discuss in their book. There's a possibility that people can detect one another and choose who they interact with. It might be a case simply of spatial location and interacting with neighbors rather than being in a random mixing population, okay? Some societies are societies where you interact mainly with your neighbors, right? Some organisms are organisms that interact with somebody growing on the same rock who are their neighbors. Some aren't. It makes a difference. It makes a difference. And this is really the most dramatic difference because you don't need common knowledge of rationality. All you need is rationality in the game theoretic sense of the word to predict the two rational players in this game will defect. So evolution may take you in a different direction. Okay? It remains to be seen whether the models that give you this result are models that that make sense, because you always have to think, if there is some positive correlation, couldn't the defectors somehow evolve a way of cheating, right? So that the cooperators meet them more often and get penalized, and the defectors make that big 15, right? If there's a big 15 there, it's better than 10, and evolution is an opportunist, right? So it's not enough to wheel in correlation ex machina to solve the problem of cooperation. You have to think about the coevolution of mechanisms of correlation of interactions between people and behavior in situations that are well modeled by the prisoner's dilemma. Okay, that's my second example, and I want to move to a third example. This is an example that speaks to the point I made at the beginning, that the equilibrium selection problem seems to be intractable in certain games because of considerations of symmetry. There are multiple equilibria, and symmetry of the game makes one equilibrium just as good as any other. Anything that can be said for one in terms of the intrinsic structure of the game can be said for the other. Okay. You could try to, again, to bring in something ex cathedra, like salience, to solve the problem. But somehow, there may not be any salience. Salience is something, just something that makes everybody think of one equilibrium as the one they ought to try. Right? Okay, might not be there. And then you have a problem in rational choice-based game theory. What happens with the curse of symmetry in the evolutionary dynamical systems approach? Well, I'd like to discuss it in the context of the game that are sender-receiver games that I talked about in the beginning. Right? Remember, there are these messages that don't have any intrinsic meaning, and there are different equilibria that endow the messages with meaning, as well as other equilibria that don't endow them with anything. And there's no reason to choose one of these signaling system equilibria over the other. So how do they get the meaning if they don't have any to start with, right? Well, if the players had another language and they could meet beforehand, they could conspire, right? And they could say, okay, red flag means state one. Okay. But if we're interested in philosophical problems, as David Lewis and Quine were, we're interested in how the meaning starts out in the first place, right? When there isn't any language in which to conduct the negotiations to settle conventions of meaning. And symmetry seems to be a big problem here, right? If we can't give any principled reason why one convention rather than another should be chosen, how do the guys get to choose a convention and coordinate on one, rather than just blundering around? Well, the first hopeful sign is that if you look at these games as they were formulated in Lewis, that is, with exactly the same number of states, messages, and acts, you can show that something is a signaling system equilibrium if and only if it's an evolutionarily stable strategy. Okay. Well, that's pretty good, right? So if we get to a stable strategy that takes over the whole population, it's a signaling system equilibrium, and you've got meaning. Okay. Now for the hard part, right? The hard part is, how do you get there, right, if you do get there? Because in some games, right, it's not a foregone conclusion that you'll get to an evolutionarily stable strategy. Remember, in the Nash bargaining game, there was a unique evolutionarily stable strategy, but there was no guarantee that you would get there. There were some states of the system that were polymorphisms, which were traps, which you could get caught in, and you'd never get to the evolutionarily stable strategy taking over the whole population. Well, then you have to look at dynamics of signaling system games. And the dynamics, well, let me first say replicator dynamics, and then I'll say something else about how this generalizes. The dynamics of signaling system games make all the other equilibria of the games dynamically unstable. And furthermore, the dynamics, okay, so you can say there are other equilibria where people don't get the meaning across or where partial meaning gets across, babbling equilibria, pooling equilibria. They're all dynamically unstable, okay? Dynamics tells you why you don't see them, right? If you rolled a ball down a knife edge, right, you wouldn't expect to mostly see it on the knife edge at the end, right? You'd expect it to fall off on one side or the other. Even better, if you have a simple model of these games, you can prove analytically that there's global convergence from almost every possible starting point to a signaling system equilibrium. You can't say which signaling system equilibrium it will converge to, because it could converge to one or to the other, right? But you can say that it will converge to a signaling system equilibrium under the replicator dynamics for almost all initial conditions, right? All but ones that have probability zero in an appropriate measure. Okay, and this can be proved. For more complicated signaling systems with lots of signals and lots of states, it's analytically pretty messy. But if you run a big simulation and use Monte Carlo methods, you get the same result. You always get a signaling system equilibrium. Okay, and the reason must be the same. If you look at the little game where you can do the analytic proofs, where you can actually prove that we have this kind of global convergence, using a Lyapunov function for the signaling system. You can also show that it works for dynamical systems that are close to a signaling, to replicator dynamics. It doesn't have to be replicator dynamics. That is, you can prove that this result is structurally stable, right? A little perturbation in the dynamics that moves it to a slightly different adaptive dynamics gives the same result. So this is the answer to the general skepticism about how you could get meaning if lots of different meaning systems are equally good and there's no rational choice reason for choosing one than the other. And that is the reason that the ball falls from one edge of the knife edge to the other, or that the stretched hair breaks one place or another, right? It's the dynamics, right? That these things are global attractors. And any other result is dynamically unstable, and you shouldn't expect to see it. This is another difference, of course, from rational choice theory, because rational choice theory has to break the symmetry in a rational way. And the problem with these examples is that there is no rational way to break the system, the symmetry. But dynamics doesn't have to break a symmetry in a rational way. Okay, well, there are three little examples. They actually correspond to chapters 1, 3, and 5 in my book, in which we have the adaptive dynamical approach showing certain differences from the pure rational choice approach. One, the fact that you have a kind of symmetry requirement that's imposed by the Darwinian veil of ignorance, by the fact that people don't endure, strategies endure. Two, the fact that correlation in encounters between types can give you results that are really rejected by the weakest theory of rational choice-based game theory, the theory that just says that the actors are rational, even though they might not have common knowledge of rationality. And three, the fact that symmetries sometimes can't be broken by rational choice, but can be broken by adaptive dynamics. And each of these has rather important consequences for a general theory of the social contract. They can be put together in various ways. For instance, if you took the middle example and said correlation is important, if you meet your own type more often than just by chance, interesting things can happen, and we do find correlation in nature in various ways, you might put that together with the problem of chapter one and say, what if we put a little correlation in this bargaining game? What happens then is the egalitarian norm arises all the time, right? That is, the basin of attraction of the polymorphisms shrink to zero. And it doesn't take much correlation, okay? So a little population viscosity gets us out of those traps that were a kind of lingering question about what was going on in divide the dollar bargaining game. Or we could take our signaling game and combine it with a bargaining game so that players are endowed with signals that have no antecedent meaning, and they exchange those signals and then play the bargaining game and see what evolves in that context. And in fact, what evolves in that context is that the signals tend to set up some transient correlation, which leads the players to the egalitarian solution much more often, say 98.5% of the time, than they would if they didn't have these signals. Okay. So in various ways, I think, the kinds of differences between the adaptive dynamics approach and the rational choice approach can really be used to illuminate key issues in evolution of the social contract. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We now go into a question period. Brian's kindly agreed to answer questions from the floor. We have mics both upstairs and downstairs. If anybody wants to ask a question, could indicate that to me, then I'll get a mic to them so that everyone can hear the question, including Brian. Anybody like to? Ian? Richard? So down the front here.
Rational choice theory really has two pretensions. Claim to be an explanatory stroke descriptive theory, and it also claims to be a normative theory. Well, it's not the normative dimension of the problem, but also a practical theory. It's supposed to answer the question of what one, tell you what you should do in particular circumstances. Now, if I understand correctly, what you've been saying is that what you have here is an alternative explanatory theory. But one might legitimately say, well, does it help us in deciding what to do at all? If I'm facing a coordination problem, I still don't know what to do. I mean, I can study the replicator dynamics. I know if I make the wrong decision, I'll get driven out of the population. And that's bad luck for me, but that doesn't help me very much. Is that right? There is no...
That's absolutely right. I would sharply divide the normative question from the descriptive question. Some economists really are loath to do this and want whatever theory it is to be both at the same time. But I'm with the other camp that says they should be different. And to the extent that rational choice is testable, I mean, there's a lot of leeway in rational choice theory because there's a lot of leeway in terms of utility. But to the extent that it's testable, I think that it does tend to be falsified as a universal descriptive theory. And I think that Bayesian rationality is absolutely right as a prescriptive theory of rationality. So that would be my answer. Many people will disagree with that.
That's Andy Craig next, so microphone doesn't need to move very far.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah, I guess I was going to ask a question. Well, I was going to ask Richard's question, but let me ask it again, but a different way. Yeah, so you I fully agree. You to separate sharply the normative from the descriptive question. Yeah, but and it did seem like these guys doing the rational approach were trying to answer both. But now but throughout the book and in the talk, you do toss out these little teasers about implications for social philosophy from this work. And I think the work would be hugely interesting even if it didn't have any such implications. I'm just trying to extract from you what further premises. You know, so one premise would be this stuff about evolutionarily stable strategies being Nash centers of Nash equilibrium. Can you then tell me what further premises I would then add to then get the normative conclusion?
I don't think of myself being in the normative game. If social philosophy is going to tell you what society ought to be like, right? I'm not in that business. I would feel inadequate, right? If somebody said, "Oh, Dr. Skirms, you're a philosopher. What should society be like?" I mean, I could say what I think, just like anyone else. But I'm not a prophet. I don't know how you derive such conclusions. I don't think philosophers are any better at telling you how things ought to be, how you should live your life, or how society should be, than anybody else. But I think that if you're worried about practical matters about society, you do need to get the description right. I mean, you have to understand how it works, right, and how norms do evolve. Otherwise, you tend to become lost in some kind of utopian exercise. So that's my answer.
two rows behind you, Craig.
Thank you. This is a question about your optimism about finding non-babbling equilibria in the signaling games. Do you think, given the difficulty and the frequency, the difficulty of getting understood and the frequency of misunderstanding, do you think there's any evidence that we don't lurch from polymorphism, unstable polymorphism, to unstable polymorphism in the various communication games we're engaged in?
Okay. I can actually point you to a nice experiment, believe it or not, done by Bloom, De Jong, Kim, and Sprinkle on just this game. And they were interested in whether you needed salience to select an equilibrium in this game. So they had students play a signaling game with two states of the world, two signals, and two acts, right? And the sender was told the state of the world, sent a signal to the receiver using a computer terminal, and the receiver indicates an act. The signals were the pound sign and the asterisk on the computer keyboard. Elaborate precautions were taken to make sure that there wasn't any special natural salience. For instance, the position in which they appeared on the screen when you typed them in was randomized from trial to trial. They played this game with undergraduates in their college, and had repeated trials and announced the results after every trial. Signaling systems spontaneously emerged every time. In usually about 16 trials, the population of, I think it was 20, converge to a signaling system.
Okay, I suppose my question was about how one then, whether one can say anything about, let's say, language by looking at these signaling games. It strikes me that one of the significant differences is that we maintain the meaning of language without strong incentives present. So I can see that in that sort of context, you evolve to a system of meaning, and yet we maintain meanings without the payoffs that support the equilibrium you're describing.
Well, certainly saying, what about language in a real society, you know, and things change, and that raises more than one question, right? So I certainly not near to have any account of a whole language in a real society, or even of sentences. Right? That is, we're dealing with simple one sentence, one symbol signals, right? And that's just where things start. But at least it does start, right? I mean, the philosophical skepticism that seems to argue that you couldn't possibly get off the ground unless you had the meanings attached to the symbols to start with somewhere, right, is shown to be wrong. The dynamic shows you can get off the ground and get some basic primitive meaning attached to symbols. Now, you would like to be able to say, well, from there, we'd like to see how you build things up bit by bit. How do you get compositionality? How do you get subject-predicate structure? How do you get truth functions in? Once you get truth functions, how do you get logical inference? Okay. And more, right? I mean, you can think of much more complicated things to ask me. I've done a little work on inference. And I have a paper that's just come out in one of the Santa Fe volumes called Dynamics in Primate Societies or something like that, where I try to do something with inference. And there I have an account of the evolution of still one sentence things that have proto-truth function, that have truth functional meaning. I call them proto-truth functions. And of inferences when you have many senders and one receiver. Okay, so that's another little baby step. To get compositionality, I think it's a great project, but I don't have anything to deliver at this time.
I wonder about the game where we had to guess the mean, I mean not we, but people upstairs, the mean, half the mean of the numbers that were submitted. I mean, obviously zero is not the answer because people don't think that far ahead. I mean, there's only a certain level of smartness that you assume in the people playing this game. So I wonder, is there something like a viscosity of thought? I mean, that you have only, you don't have common knowledge of rationality, but something that is highly viscous in that respect?
Okay, so you're asking a question about procedural rationality. Wouldn't it be nice to have some kind, I think, some kind of theory of procedural rationality so that people who had it didn't immediately see through everything, but went forward in reasonable ways? And sure, I agree. And I sort of tried to do something along those lines in the book on Dynamics of Rational Deliberation, that was sort of a baby step too, and I think that there's a lot that needs to be done before we have any good theory of that kind, right? There are some other steps too, right? There are a number of papers about games played by automata. Right, Ariel Rubinstein has a paper, Ken Binmore has a paper, and there are a few things using that kind of procedural rationality, it doesn't have the psychological realism, but it has a real theory about how these things do it, right, so that you can get precise analysis and good results. If you want psychological realism, then you need a good psychological theory about how people deal with these problems, and I'm not sure we have it.
Brian, would you say a little bit about how it's often the case in the analysis of games that the solution depends on the assumptions about the dynamics? In your previous book, The Dynamics of Rational Deliberation, you talk mainly about replicator dynamics, just like you've talked today, but you also talk about the Darwin dynamics, and there's a third one whose name escapes me. And it was really surprising to me in reading this that the qualitative character of the solutions can change so much from one dynamical assumption to another. What do you think the significance of that is?
Okay, so there's fictitious play dynamics, which is the other most widely studied dynamics, where players make some update about their beliefs about what the other player will do based on the frequency of past actions. Okay, and fictitious play can be described this way to philosophers. Everybody is correctly described by Carnap's inductive logic, right? And people use Carnap's inductive logic to assign a probability that the other player will play things, and then they optimize against that probability distribution over other players' plays. You have to use the most general notion of Carnap, and there are some parameters and so on. Different people might have different parameter values. Fictitious play eliminates weakly dominated strategies. Replicator dynamics doesn't, right? So that's a big difference, right? And actually, I think Larry Samuelson may be the first person that pointed that out about replicator dynamics. So from the standpoint of a game theorist wanting to get rid of questionable things, fictitious play is better. But from the standpoint of describing how people act, replicator dynamics is better because people do play weakly dominated strategies, even though maybe they shouldn't. If you want more psychological realism, it's possible that there might be a better... you might want to combine two approaches. Replicator dynamics is a kind of non-strategic approach, and that's one of the reasons why it works across a broad spectrum of biological examples. The replicator dynamics works not by trying to figure out what the other guy is going to do, right, but just by either reproducing, right, or if you're an individual learning, by raising the probability of what's giving you better payoffs. So it's just a kind of reinforcement, right, and has no strategic sophistication. Fictitious play has a slight level of strategic sophistication. You know you're playing somebody else, right, and you want to optimize against that person's play. You predict that person's play, and then you optimize, right? Second level of strategic sophistication might be, you might say, uh-oh, that guy's probably trying to optimize against me. So there are various things you could combine. There is evidence in the population, in the general population of humans, that there's a range of strategic sophistication. Some people aren't thinking that far ahead in terms of back and forth, and some are, right? Doesn't go very high, right? But 0, 1, 2, 3, maybe. So there's a range of strategic sophistication. There's a kind of question of how you combine the reinforcement aspect with the prediction aspect, right? And it might be different for different people, right? And they might both work at the same time to a certain extent. Some people are working on such theories. There are a number of papers by Colin Kammerer. In particular, there's a paper by Kammerer and Ho in which they want to develop a model that has both a kind of strategic prediction of the other, and but instead of simply optimizing against your prediction, you sort of go in the direction adaptively toward what would be optimal given your prediction. Because, I don't know, if you want to think of it from the rational choice point of view, maybe you've got higher order doubts about your method of prediction, right? So you're not willing to say, oh, this is it, I'll optimize 100% of it. You're a little more cautious. Such theories are being developed, and then it's an ongoing enterprise to test them to see what's the most psychological realistic theory about how people actually do it.
Carl,
next. Yeah, I don't know if you can easily get hold of your slide of Nash from Nature, but if you can, I had a question about that.
Shouldn't be too hard.
Okay. my question really centers around the remarks you made after putting the slide up, which seemed to be some sort of endorsement of standard rational choice sort of game theory analyses, telling philosophers not to dismiss them on the basis of these sorts of facts that Nash equilibria develop out of replicator dynamics sorts of models. So the first question is, shouldn't the ifs also go the other way? If you really want to endorse the other sort of approach, shouldn't you want to find that the Nash equilibrium arrived at by ordinary game theory also is going to be an evolutionary stable strategy?
Okay. Before I answer the first question, let me make the first qualification, and that is that when we're using the replicator dynamics on this slide, we're assuming random encounters from the population. Okay, this is a random mixing population. If you put in population viscosity, as I did when I discussed prisoner's dilemma and some other things, everything changes. Right? Then it's no longer true. So let's bear that random mixing assumption in mind and move on to your question.
Yeah. Well,
wouldn't it be better if it went both ways? And it doesn't, right, as you know. the converse of one is false, and the converse of two is false. Part of the reason is that that Nash equilibrium concept doesn't really have a stability requirement in it, right? It says you're not any better deviating from this equilibrium, okay? You don't have a motive for deviating, but it doesn't say you're worse, right? If everybody who unilaterally deviated would be worse, that's called a strict Nash equilibrium, okay? And that is a stability concept, right? So Maynard Smith in Evolutionarily Stable Strategies was looking for something that's stable, right? That you do a little perturbation and the perturbation goes away and you're back at the equilibrium. So if AA is a strict Nash equilibrium in the corresponding game, is A an evolutionarily stable strategy? Okay, answer's yes.
Okay, that's helpful.
Okay, but then the things in this direction don't exactly work because strict Nash equilibrium is a little stronger, and but these are technical points. That is, between Nash equilibrium and strict Nash equilibrium, we find we find this. Okay, they're all pretty much in the same ballpark, mm-hmm. right? Or in the same 10 meters of the same ballpark. They're pretty close together, but there are technical differences that prevent us from giving you a real nice equivalence.
Okay. The more general aspect of the question is, if you're really advocating a sort of a different tradition, a different explanatory descriptive tradition, then why sort of defend Nash equilibrium and ordinary game theory at all? I mean, what's the advantage of those sorts of studies when you can do replicator dynamics sort of studies instead?
You mean if I'm selling this, why shouldn't I say this is pretty good too? I mean, because it is. I mean.
But presumably,
fair is fair.
If you're trying to explain what's actually going on in a real context, it can't be two stories radically different sort of ontology and causation that are both equally good.
Well, no, but as I said, there really are similarities between the two theories, and there are differences. Okay, and the similarities are important, and they really show that in the right kind of setting, this equilibrium concept, which seems rather hard to motivate from the point of view of rationality of people, right, is not so hard to motivate from the point of view of adaptive systems. Okay, I think that needs to be said. But there are special assumptions going into this story, right? If, for instance, we have population viscosity, okay, this slide is no longer true. Okay, sometimes we do have population viscosity. Then the two theories give you different results. Okay, now let's look at the results and see which one is better description of the real world. So I would say where the theories disagree, the adaptive dynamics approach gives you a better description of the world than the rational choice approach. But they don't always disagree.
There are at least three people who want to ask questions, but I'm afraid I'm going to have to bring it to a halt here. I'd ask them to ask Brian their question over a glass of champagne upstairs. Might be a more pleasant time to do it. Because we are on a tight schedule with various celebrations of the Lakatos Award, the next step is for everyone, I hope, you're certainly all invited, to come upstairs to the Shaw Library. Veterans of these occasions will expect the senior comm room, where they'll find the Modern Law Review, not the Lakatos Award. So it's in the Shaw Library, which is keep going up the stairs or up the lift as far as you can go, and then turn right out of the lift and go as far as you can go, or turn right up the stairs and turn as far as you can go. Shaw Library, also known as the Founders Room, on the sixth floor, where there will be a reception and the actual award will be made, and those of you who didn't get a chance to ask your question will get a chance to ask it directly to Brian then. Okay, well, I think...
And they can collect the prize.
Oh, and the prize winner, who I think has gone, however, that's lucky. And if they are still around, can nab me to get their prize. I think we should just finish, obviously, by thanking Brian Skerms for a really interesting lecture and for the clear and sharp way in which he's answered your questions. Thank you very much.